sex. In all honesty, there is usually nothing so interesting or fascinating than wondering about other people's sex lives. While the story of London has occasionally brushed upon matters licentious and scandalous, on the whole we have avoided specifically talking about the sex life of London. And there was a reason for this. Mostly because London, as a city, really didn't like talking about the sex life of a city. That's until around 1416, when London could not but talk about it. And what it tells us is fascinating. Hi, my name is Saul, and this is The Story of London, the podcast that tries to tell the chronological history of the city in regular weekly chapters. And we've reached the 150th chapter of this podcast, a milestone I never thought we'd actually reach. And to celebrate, if that's the correct term, I've decided to do a special episode to do with sex, sexuality, and London in the 15th century. It's the tale of London coming to terms with a rather burgeoning and somewhat succulent sex trade, of a multitude of sins of the flesh being hinted at and alluded to in formal Latin documents, and above all, it's the story of what appears to be a trans woman sex worker and a rather salacious event that took place in Soper's Lane. Welcome then to this, the 150th chapter of The Story of London, Carnal Appetites. The London sex trade had kind of always been there. And part of the reason we have difficulties finding out about it is because London liked to talk about and document and write about everything else apart from its sex trade. One should never remove this aspect of life from all the other aspects of life. London had, at all times in its history, a million things going on. But it was also a place where part of those million things going on included what was going on in the privacy of people's bedrooms. And by a way of insight into what happened in 1416 that caused me to time this episode to happen now, we need to go back a few years to December 1394, to be precise, 21 years previously. These were events we covered actually 9 chapters ago, around about chapter 141 or so, the one called Majesty. Back then, Richard II was on the throne, and London was dealing with this capricious king, removing political power from the city. And there in the cold winter evening of December, a rather illicit activity took place. One Sunday evening in December 1394, Eleanor Reichenau walked the streets of Cheap Ward. It was no doubt very cold that night, and Eleanor was no doubt bundled up. But she was still woman enough to catch the eye of a visiting Yorkshireman called John Britby. Britby was in town on business, and he was travelling along Cheapside when his eye spotted Eleanor. He approached her and asked her if she would have sex with him for cash. Eleanor agreed and named a price. Britby considered that reasonable, and the two withdrew a short distance, turning left of Cheapside to find themselves on Soper's Lane. It was dark, the place was mostly deserted, and the market stalls around Soper's Lane were deserted, and there, behind one of them, they started to do the deed. Now, what they actually did is a matter of some debate. The wording of the legal case afterwards leaves it rather ambiguous. The scandalised court clerk described it as, quote, that detestable, unmentionable, ignominious vice, unquote. Now, for some, and for reasons that will become obvious, this suggests that Britby and Eleanor were engaged in a little bit of anal sex behind the stall in Soper's Lane that cold December evening. But it could have been oral. Alas, however, the fact that there is a court case goes to show they were seen. A couple of ward officers saw the pair of them and arrested them there and then. And it was around this moment that they discovered that the attractive young woman Eleanor Reichener was actually an attractive young man called John Reichener, wearing a dress. And immediately here in 1394, we see the case of a young female prostitute suddenly become a case involving a cross-dressing queer man, and very quickly, oh, this case gets way more interesting. Reichener and Britby were then interrogated separately by the then mayor and the alderman. Now, we don't know the precise date of the interrogation. It's doubtful it would happen that night, but it could well have happened as soon as the next day. Now, Reichener's interrogation at this point throws up a heap of details into a fascinating story of sex and sexuality. And at this point, I feel I need to add a disclaimer. I'm talking about events in the 14th and 15th century, but I am speaking now in 2025. A world has moved on and has evolved and changed, and it is wonderful. But in talking about sex and sexuality, of gender fluidity and identity, I have to take on board that we live in a world fraught with an ongoing series of passionate debates about this issue. Now, these issues are more heavily debated in nations that have a long history of highly conservative, extremist, sectarian Christian groups polluting the discourse on this matter. So, you know, the United States, basically. But the growth of mass social media has brought many of these passionate debates to this side of the Atlantic, as extremist, sectarian, Christian views have been weaponized. So let me be clear where I stand and offer this as a disclaimer. I believe that it is right to call someone by their given name, and if they wish to have new pronouns used, then I will do so. This is a basic thing to do and is not really an issue. But by way of comparison, recently an American called Robert Provost changed his name to Leo XIV and taken the preferred pronouns of Holiness and the Pope. About a billion Catholics have recognized this change immediately, and it caused them no hassle whatsoever. Beyond that, billions of non-Catholics recognized this change, including the entire world's media, and no one had a meltdown, no one had a crisis, and no one was especially put out, well, making the change. Recognizing names and pronouns is an easy task. It carries no baggage with it whatsoever, unless we bring the baggage with us. And at that point, that's a you problem, not a rest of humanity problem. So I have no problem recognizing and using preferred pronouns, and I don't believe in dead naming people, as it is simply a courtesy and polite. But take on board, I'm also talking about the world 500 years ago, a world where these concerns and debates simply did not exist. While we can be informed about our past through a better understanding of ourselves, we must take on board that we are creatures of a different land. Even residents of London today, while we share the same geographic space as the Londoners of the 15th century, keep in mind that the way they thought about the world was different from us. They are so foreign to us that people living today on differing continents have more in common with us than they do. They are the true aliens to us. One of the worst things about being a historian is seeing how the events of the past are rewritten by imperialists and colonizers. People from one culture would turn up and with a stroke of a pen erase other people's histories, their language, their context of whom they were, because it did not suit these new people's way of conceptualizing the world. And while we see that most strikingly with the rather awful Victorians, whose revision of history was oft-times repulsive and marvelously racist, we must be aware that even well-intentioned people today can do the same. So while I am sensitive to modern sensibilities and concerns, we must not shy away from using terms used at the time, mentioning judgments used at the time, using language that was used at the time, and also by historians in the subsequent few hundred years to talk about events. We must not use our offence at such terms to act like colonizers and erase a native's history just because we don't like it. Rather, we have to embrace how they worded things and examined the mindsets of the past honestly, offensive and triggering words and all. That's the only way we can ever understand how they thought. Which is a long-winded way to say I'm aware that using terms like sodomite and transvestite can cause offence within certain communities, especially within the United States, and be warned they will come up, but at least now you know why. And all of this I've just said may not be required. I am aware that my core demographic in terms of age is somewhat older and not given to such passions and concerns, and I appreciate that. But I am a historian, and I work in the field of history, and as such, many of our students tend to be of the younger demographic to whom such passions are important, and so I have caveats and disclaimers. Our first issue is what gender we assign to this Reichener person. Regarding pronouns, the original Latin refers to Reichener in an indeterminate gender. Where the Latin specifies a gender, it does so in the translation, and some translators have noticed that the feminine is used only twice to refer to Reichener, both in indirect speech. We have no idea of how Reichener wished to be referred to by themselves, but we do get the distinct impression that she used Eleanor when working in one job and he used John when working in another, and swapped between the two. I will be referring to them preferably by their surname when possible, but will use they-thou pronouns and will only use him when the testimony does actually use that term. Please be aware that the caveat to all of this, it was clear that the mayor and the alderman were rather bewildered by who they were talking to. So let's get back to our story then, shall we? The mayor and the alderman of London were confronted by a female presenting prostitute who had male genitalia. They were incredibly confused, and they asked Reichener where the idea for such work apparently came from. Reichener replied that, quote, a certain Anna, the whore of a former servant of Sir Thomas Blount, unquote, had taught him how to act as a woman, and that another woman called Elizabeth Brownerer first dressed him as a woman. Now, some historians have postulated that Anna, the prostitute from whom Reichener learned how to appear and act as a woman, was probably a foreigner. The name Anna was relatively rare in England at the time, but was common over in the Low Countries. We know that during the Peasants' Revolt, there was a stew or brothel of women from Flanders and the Low Countries, just south of London Bridge. And we know that from the poll tax of 1381, many of the women living in that region had the rather significant surname of Fro, a version of the Dutch word for woman. Indeed, one historian has postulated that round about 1380, the poll tax records indicate most of the stews of London in that region employed foreign female servants, and there were complaints of a Flemish monopoly over the sex trade in Southwark. The mayor and the alderman decided to bombard Reichener with questions. Reichener described in some detail two crafts, that of working with needles in the ancient art of embroidery, and also of the more ancient art of sex work, and described how they learned to make a living from both of these at the hands of Elizabeth Brodera, who possibly introduced him to the Flemish sex worker. Now, the questions at this point seem to focus as much upon the act of dressing as a woman as it did on his sexual activities. There was a palpable sense of surprise going on. How could you, as a man, want to dress as a woman? Reichener described first being dressed by Bordener at a house in Bishopsgate. It's worth noting that after the first eruption of the plague and the mass loss of life back in 1349, where maybe up to one half of the English population had died, female apprenticeships had become as common as those for boys, particularly in London, and unusual apprentices does seem to happen. And it appears that Reichener was sent to live with Bordener to learn the fundamentals of embroidery under Elizabeth's tutelage. And it does turn out that she also taught him the finer arts of sex work. And Reichener was paid to do both, being skilled in the act of pleasuring both men and women. Elizabeth Brownerer, as well as being the one who dressed him in women's clothing, also worked in pimping out her own daughter, a child called Alice, to various customers. Reichener and Alice were both used to have sex with clients, and Reichener recalls that Elizabeth would arrange for Alice to join men in darkened rooms at night, making her leave early in the morning, and then claiming the next morning that the girl they'd been pleasured by had been Eleanor, aka John Reichener, dressed in women's clothing. Reichener went on to say that after this introduction, several of the clients had carried on seeing Reichener, including a rector called Philip. After working in the Bishopsgate region, Reichenau then struck out and started working by themselves. By August 1394, Reichenau had moved to Oxford, continuing with sex work, but also obtaining work as an embroideress, or embroiderer. Amongst Reichenau's sexual clients were, according to Reichenau, quote, three unsuspecting scholars, unquote. They may not have known Reichenau's birth sex at first, but they apparently used Reichenau's services frequently, so they could not claim to be unsuspecting for too long. Reichenau quickly gained a wealthy, often ecclesiastical clientele in both professions. You see, the upper classes liked to employ embroiderers, especially the clergy, for their very ornate ecclesiastical vestments. A month later, Reichenau moved out of Oxford and moved west to Burford and was employed as a barmaid by an innkeeper called John Clerk. And sexual customers during this time, Reichenau claimed, were two Franciscan friars who paid Reichenau with a gold ring. And there was also a Carmelite friar, and business was six foreigners. It's from the foreign customers of the sex worker we get that they were paid between 12 and 20 pence an encounter. But on one occasion they gained, quote, as much as 2 shillings for a single encounter, unquote. Reichenau also slept with female customers, and as a male had a relationship with a woman called Joan Matthew, although there is no record of how much he charged. Reichenau was also uncertain, when specifically asked, whether the woman they were partners with were married or not. But their number did include nuns, quote, how many he did not know, unquote. Now, Reichenau's response here suggested that the mayor and the alderman were particularly concerned with the moral question of adulterous married women and sexually active religious women, more than just the act of women paying for sex. It's more the nuns and the married women they're worried about. Beyond that, yeah, pay for sex if you want. Reichenau told the mayor that the mainstay of all these encounters, whether with men or women, occurred in taverns or in private houses. And if all else fails, of course, in public places, as we'd just seen with the incident with the Yorkshireman. After a brief stay in Burford, Reichenau ended up in the village of Beaconsfield in Buckinghamshire, about 20-odd miles northwest of London. And there, their clients included two foreign-born Franciscan monks. Reichenau finally returned to London later in the year and claimed to have, since doing so, had encounters with one of their previous clients from Oxford, who was now a chaplain, along with a couple of other chaplains who became customers in the back streets around the Church of St. Catherine's by the Tower. Oddly enough, all this testimony, deliberately or otherwise, only did one thing. It revealed that any offences were beyond the mayor's jurisdiction. Britby, in his interrogation, supposedly said he was totally unaware of Reichenau's birth sex at start, but was aware when they got caught, and yet Britby does not seem to have been charged with any crime. Meanwhile, the one crime Reichenau could have been charged with, the crime of fornication, would have been had to be prosecuted in an ecclesiastical court, and that was again beyond the mayoral court's jurisdiction. Prostitutes were generally not prosecuted in the mayor's court. And probably Reichenau was sufficiently different to warrant the mayor's notice, being basically a prostitute who was not a poor young woman and didn't appear to be the pawn of a procurer and obviously was not offering vaginal sex. I mean, ultimately, if Reichenau was ever charged with any offence, which we don't think they were, the outcome is entirely lost. There is nothing more beyond this interrogation. And understand, for the mayor and the alderman at the time, a prostitute was not just a woman who took money for sex. No, no. A prostitute was ultimately a sinful woman. Therefore, even if a man took money for sex, which is likely how Reichenau could have been perceived, they could not be, to the medieval mind, a prostitute, nor could they be prosecuted as one. There are several other issues about the Reichenau case that we don't know about. And at the time, the priorities of what was said don't necessarily mesh with the priorities we want to think about. Is the Reichenau case indicative of some kind of LGBTQ+ scene in London at the time? No, we have to be honest, there wasn't really a scene at the time. The most interesting contemporary reaction to the Reichenau case, especially from historians, was that around the same time you had the Lollard heresy, and several of their members were going to be condemning the Catholic Church for, well, the debauchery of priests. And Reichenau's testimony seemed to be perfectly suited to, you know, prove that case. It was seen as a curiosity, hence why the mayor and the alderman wanted to see Reichenau. But we attach importance to it. And there's another reason why we attach importance to it, because of what happened around the year 1416 and 1417, 20-odd years later. You see, the mayor of the time, Wotton, made a decree about London's sex life. The proclamation he made begins, quote, "Whereas heretofore many grievances, abominations, damages, disturbances, murders, homicides, larcenies, and other common nuisances have oftentimes ensued and befallen in the city of London and the suburbs thereof, by reason and cause of the common resort, harbouring and sojourning, which lewd men and women of bad and evil life have in the stews belonging to men and women in the city and suburbs aforesaid," unquote. Yep, this proclamation was an opening salvo that was to speak about the brothels of London, the stews of the city, and the bedrock of London's sex trade. And, according to that proclamation, the source of utter carnage. Around the illegal and ambiguous world of the sex trade, we see theft, murder and more taking place. Illegality draws illegality. A liminal space between respectability and criminality draws like to like, aka the sex trade is bad for London. But what is most interesting is what Mayor Wotton describes as this sex trade's principal sins. Quote, "A thing to be lamented, diverse men and women have been of late slain, spoiled and robbed for the cause and reason aforesaid," unquote. So there is little here in this condemnation of the sex trade to condemn the actual sex itself. The reason why London's responding to the sex trade is it causes people to kill and be robbed. Oh, and specifically, for people to be spoiled. The term most often used to describe loss of virginity, but could also describe a loss of innocence. It's like the Reichenau case. There doesn't seem to be particular outrage about what you're doing or who you're doing it with. More that you're doing it at all in the first place. But crucially, what this proclamation from 1417 goes on to say is, quote, "What is even worse, from one day to another, the wives, sons, daughters, apprentices and servants of reputable men of the city are oftentimes subtly, by false imagining, colouring and coven, as well as those who keep the said stews, as of others for a little money, drawn and enticed thereto. And there they, as well as other persons, both regular and secular, are permitted to do and carry on the illicit works of their lewd flesh," unquote. What's crucial here is that the mayor takes a moment to describe the dangers of the London sex trade, but in a rather fluid way, noting it accuses the whoremakers and sex workers of subtly and with, quote, "false imagining," unquote, tempting others to join their profession, flattery working as much as financial reward. And in a city that is suffering from such a shortage of cash, it should come as no surprise that people will be tempted into prostitution for a little money. Where the section gets interesting is where it talks about the people who become the victims of it. Now, London's wives and daughters fit our traditional image of how this would work, but notice it also has vague mentions of phrases like servants and apprentices, and that could be either gender. But then it goes on and it does specifically mention sons. It does seem to be saying that young men are also, like Reichenau, being drawn into the sex trade itself at this time. And once again, you notice it does not speak of any distinction between, say, gay sex or straight sex. It does not, as Räikkönen's testimony reveals to us, speak of any kind of scene. There's no distinction between the types of sex or the genders involved in this proclamation. Rather, there is, behind the condemnation of all the sex acts, a complete understanding of, well, a fluid situation. A rather Catholic approach. A universal willingness to put everything together. The edict goes on to say about the Stuarts that, quote, hereupon, Henry Barton, mayor, and the alderman of the City of London, with the assent of the commons, to the pleasing of God, and to the salvation of their souls, the removal of the evils aforesaid, and the purifying and decency of the said city on the one hand, and to the great profit and common advantage on the other, did ordain and establish for ever to hold good that no man or woman in the City of London or in the suburbs, therefore, should from thenceforth keep any stews within the City of London or the suburbs thereof, unquote. Yep, the whole point of this proclamation was to condemn and then to ban the stews, all the stews in London and around it. And they went on to additionally ban, quote, for lodging therein any man or woman by day or by night on pain of paying £5 to the chamber every time that anyone should be convicted, and further of being punished and of making fine at the discretion of the mayor and alderman, unquote. So there it was. Anybody caught residing in a stew would be fined at least £5. This way they could get rid of the trade. There is an odd note just at the end of this proclamation that does bear a little bit of examination. Because just after they say anybody residing or having a stew would pay £5 per offence, the proclamation then says, quote, provided always that every person of the city for his own seemliness might lawfully have and make in his own house a stew or other beseeming thing to use of him and his household, unquote. Which is an odd line to add. We're banning the stews of London, except that people may have their own stews. Yet, to explain, the English term stew was a derivative of the word stove, and there is the idea that what it was referring to was a heating place, not so much for cooking, but for heating water. A stew, under this explanation, roughly refers to a bath, and thus the origins of the stews of London may have been bathhouses. So while this does sound a bit confusing and a bit of a stretch, it does neatly explain that last line in the proclamation, saying that Londoners may lawfully make a stew in their house, and such a thing is beseeming and doesn't apply to the stews we are banning, which are the bathhouses. But they were not done, these good men of London. They issued another edict about the stews of London in the same year, and it reveals much. Remember, as I've said in previous episodes, laws give us great insights as to what was going on sometimes. No one passes a law for no reason whatsoever. Someone has to be doing something a lot before someone goes, oh, we need a law about that. So whereas sometimes crimes are not reported, laws can tell us the crimes that were taking place. Well, in 1417, just after issuing this decree banning the stews of London, the mayor went on to proclaim, quote, a common report runs and prevails throughout the said city of London, unquote, which basically is something that everybody knows and sees. This report claimed, quote, that when any man or woman of bad and pernicious life are dieted in any ward of the same city, at the time of the ward moots thereof, they do fly from the ward where they're so indicted, and withdraw themselves to neighbouring wards or to others near to thereto, and within the city, or in the suburbs, unquote. So, if someone like a gender-fluid sex worker was arrested in Cheapside, according to this, they would make their way to, say, Bridge Ward to base themselves, or out to Portsoken. Please note again, the document condemns men and women for such lifestyles. And traditionally, we conceptualise the women as the sex workers and the men as the pimps and the whoremasters, but given the fluidity and ambiguity of this liminal world, we cannot say for sure. We cannot say for sure that there was not a roaring business in sex workers going on, with men and women enjoying a plethora of customers, a roaring trade in priests and monks paying for carnal pleasure. And we do seem to have a profession that had deeper roots into respectable London at the time. Because while the mayor and alderman mentioned how those caught in the act would move wards, what really worried them was the fact that when they moved, They would relocate to, quote, houses belonging as well to aldermen and substantial commoners as to other persons, and there, through their maintenance, for the trifling gain that such owners have in letting their houses and so getting the rents, these persons are permitted to do and carry on the illicit work of their carnal appetites. And there they do harbour oft-times the wives, sons and daughters, servants and apprentices of free and honest persons of the city, together with the goods and chattels belonging to their parents and their masters, and also do suffer them to waste the said goods and chattels upon the hideous sins aforesaid, and the other, the most abominable deeds that one may think of or devise, unquote. So there was quite a bit to unpack in that last statement. According to the mayor, the issues here are myriad. The sex trade of London then seems to work with the implicit sanction of the richer men of the city, the aldermanic class who, as we know, due to prevailing economic conditions, had been investing into the London property market and had thus have become the city's most significant landlords. According to this accusation, they were more than happy for workers in the sex industry to rent out their properties and practice their trade. I mean, it's just a bit of rent, isn't it? But what is more is that it's not just the issue of respectable landlords renting out properties to sex workers that are bothering them here again. The mayor adds an interesting insight into the reports he's been getting, that the workers of this trade, quote, do harbour oftentimes the wives, sons, daughters, servants and apprentices of free and honest persons of the city, unquote. So again, the ambiguity and the fluidity of this world rears its head. Sons and daughters and servants, apprentices and wives. This is the original condemnation made concrete again. Once more a condemnation of people's carnal appetite, not specifically those who are having sex with men, or not specifically those who are having sex with priests, or not specifically those who are having sex with young people. It's an overall condemnation of the practice of having sex for profit, as opposed to a precise nature of who is doing what to which particular orifice. But the devil is in the detail, because these members of these respectable households who are seemingly straying into these dens of iniquity, the suggestion is that people are joining these shoes for extended periods and that they turn up, quote, with the goods and chattels belonging to their parents and masters, unquote. So there's an accusation here that the sex trade is driving, well, stolen goods and theft. And then after that, the accusation that they, quote, waste said goods and chattels upon the hideous sins aforesaid, unquote, suggesting that actually the sex trade took payment in kind. If you didn't have the money for a few nights' fun in a dark room with an embroiderer's daughter, you can pay in goods. This matches the testimony of Reichenau about taking payment from two monks after a pleasurable threesome in the form of a gold ring. And again, this ties into the original issues and the overwhelming issue London had with the sex industry at the time. It was a socially unspoken of aspect of their society, so it was not policed or regulated, as London regulated everything else, and thus seems to become a conduit for criminality. So it's not just about sex, it's about theft and pawning goods and the redistribution of goods and the enforcement of this network. And we suddenly have an entire criminal network being allowed to exist around the sex trade here, based in properties within London owned by respectable and powerful members of the community who just collected the rent and looked the other way and therefore profited from this self-made trade. Of course, the mayor wanted this to end, and thus we read, quote, therefore, the said mayor, aldermen, commoners have ordained and established that forever, that from henceforth no alderman, substantial commoner, or any persons whatsoever shall receive as a tenant within the same city or in the suburbs thereof, or shall suffer to remain on their tenantry any man or woman who has been indicted or charged of, or to be known of, evil and vicious lives on pain of paying to the chamber the value of the rent that said man or woman shall have paid to him for such tenancy. Unquote. Yep. The city would now fine the landlords for renting out their properties, and by this way, they hoped to curtail the sex trade and stamp out crime and illegality. Of course, it entirely failed. The whole thing totally failed. But the most we can say is that it would have had an impact, and it perhaps moved the sex trade out of the wards of London to a degree, as the fines and the mayor's court would have focused on these regions. And it could explain why Southwark, already associated with Flemish sex workers and stews, continued and then certainly became the centre of London's sex industry. with all that went alongside this. And it is around now, I believe, in response to these ordinances from the mayor, that the authorities in Southwark began to try and actually regulate the sex trade taking part right on their doorstep. See, it's about now we talk about a series of regulations known as the Ordinances Touching the Government of the Stewholders in Southwark under the direction of the Bishop of Winchester. See, as we said, Southwark was mostly owned by the Bishop of Winchester, and it's by now the Bishop came up with regulations to cover how the sex trade should work in his diocese, or in his region. Now, as one historian pointed out, in an attempt to give these ordinances more credibility and legitimacy, the bishop at the time claimed they were written back in 1162, suggesting they were passed, quote, in the Parliament held at Winchester in the 8th year of the reign of King Henry II, unquote. This is why when you read most accounts about these regulations, they date them all the way back to 1162. Only there's a teeny-tiny problem. It's kind of impossible for Parliament in 1162 to have passed these regulations as there was no Parliament at the time. The bishop was basically, as it appears, lying, kind of going, oh, these rules that regulate the brothels in Southwark, they're not mine. Oh, we've always had them here since forever. Let's just bring them in. Yeah, all the evidence suggests that these rules were drawn up in the 15th century. And because of that, I date their origin to be sometime in the aftermath of the edicts of 1417 on the sex trade in London. Follow the sequence of events. The mayor condemns and closes down the stews, then as a backup issue, goes after landlords to prevent them from allowing, well, people to just rent a house to practice their sex trade. And then at some point afterwards, the Bishop of Winchester produces a document that regulates the sex trade in Southwark. I see a sequence. In effect, the ordinances allowed the Bishop of Winchester to sanction and profit from sex work within his jurisdiction in Southwark. It sets out 36 regulations and rules for those working in the sex trade, and with a fine for each infraction of each of those rules. And so profitable did this venture actually prove that the sex workers of London eventually became known as the Winchester Geese. Along with the right to demand rent, the bishop was expected to impose law and order on the, quote, light-tailed housewives off the bank, unquote. So what were these rules? Well, rather than go through them one by one, I will just do broad summaries of the principal ones and the clear motive behind them. Because some of these rules were clearly designed to regulate how sex workers conducted themselves in going about their business. It was mandated that all sex workers in Southwark had to identify themselves by wearing some agreed garment indicating their trade. And they were forbidden to wear an apron, as this was the mark of a respectable woman. What the garment was, it does not say, but a customer should be able to spot a Winchester goose upon sight, thus preventing women, or arguably men, who were not involved in the sex trade from being solicited by customers, I would imagine. There is the wonderful regulation that states that no sex worker could entice any man into the brothel by pulling at his coat or any other item of clothing, and if the customers refused to come in, the sex workers were forbidden to throw stones at them or make faces at them in response, nor, quote, chide with any man or make a fray, unquote. It's also said that no stewholder's wife could entice any man into the house against his will. As if. The fact that the bishop is banning all of this does suggest an aggressive and lively trade was going on in the streets along the southern side of the river at the time. There was a rule that said no sex worker was allowed out between sunset and dawn on any day when the King's Parliament or Council was sitting in Westminster. This was to make sure that legislators didn't piss off to the brothels when they should have been working. The rules went on to say that stewholders could not employ an ostler on a contract for more than 6 months. Now, what's an ostler? Well, it's a bouncer, a big, tough man who stood outside and kept the peace inside. These men were always in demand in such a lively region. But the king kind of wanted to ensure they were always available for the armed forces, so they were only allowed 6 months contracts at a time. On top of this, all the stewholders had to allow every sex worker's final customer of the day stay overnight. This was kind of an important rule because another regulation forbid the stewholders from operating riverboats, quote, against the custom of the manor, unquote. And both these rules were designed to completely stop nighttime river traffic, with brothel customers returning to the north side to London at night, because apparently the fear was that, well, when they did so, they could conceal thieves and other ne'er-do-wells on the ship with them. The stewholders were instructed that no sex workers were allowed to work on their premises if they knew that the sex worker was either pregnant or had the burning sickness, which probably was a nice term relating to a sexually transmitted infection. Also included were regulations banning cursing and blasphemy on the premises. Yeah, I have no response to that. And since all manner of illegality seemed to be going on normally, the stewholders were specifically forbidden from allowing coin clipping on their premises. There were rudimentary rules to try and protect the sex workers. No stewholder could prevent his sex workers entering or leaving the premises at will, and each one were to pay 14 pence a week for their chamber in the brothel where they worked and most likely lived full time. Once every 3 months, the local ward officers were to conduct a search of every stew to check that no woman or boy, presumably, was being held against their will. And if there was, or they claimed they were, they would be escorted safely out of the Liberty and so beyond the stewholder's reach. It was forbidden for the stewholders to lend sex workers a total of more than 6 shillings and 8 pence. See, larger sums were to be considered void by the bishop's court. And this measure was designed to prevent the sex workers being effectively enslaved by running up large debts. Finally, the sex workers were free to board anywhere they wished to, in case they desired to find somewhere nicer. The bishop, being the bishop, did have rules on how this community should interact with the church. All stews could not be open on Sundays or religious holidays, except between the hours of noon and 2 p.m, which goes to show that even at Christmas and Easter, the lunchtime does seem to be the more popular time for someone to give you a handy. And indeed, it went further by saying all sex workers were to be out of Southwark on holy days between 8 a.m. and 11 a.m. and from 1 p.m. until 5 p.m. Crucially, while the rules said that stewholders were forbidden from accepting another man's wife into sex work without the bishop's permission, they were also said they were forbidden from tempting any nuns to join in sex work, again, not without the bishop's permission. The growing poverty amidst religious orders caused by the excruciating taxation levels of Henry V does seem to have tempted women of holy orders to swap the convent for the brothel at this time. Customers were also protected by these regulations. Stewholders were now forbidden from imprisoning any customer who refused to pay his bill. Henceforth, any disputes with fees had been taken to the bishop's court instead. And if a rich customer had removed his sword and buckler before proceeding to have fun with his other sword, the stewholder had to make sure they were returned and not, you know, sold off to a nearby fence. What's really interesting was the economic rules regarding the stews, designed to prevent any of them becoming too big or too rich. No stewholder could employ support staff beyond his wife, plus one washerwoman and one male ostler. This was to prevent the brothel expanding into a full tavern, and also to prevent a single stew from growing too large. Any sex workers in the stew were forbidden from engaging in spinning or other things during their breaks. The London guild trades of these crafts were powerful and clearly didn't want any competition. Crucially, no stew was licensed to sell food and drink from the same premises where sex workers resided. Again, this regulation seems designed to protect the surrounding taverns. Still, even with this, the sex industry was big business and profitable, and corruption of authorities does seem to have been an issue. And that's why you had regulations that added that any ward official failing to report a breach of these rules to the court should be imprisoned till he's paying whatever fine the bishop imposes. And no officer of the bishop was to accept bail personally for a prisoner's release. Rather, the bail should be paid directly to the bishop's court. And no bailiff was allowed to offer an offender bail without the court's authorization. Clearly, these rules have been put in place as local officials have profited in the past from bending them, and regulations clearly state that no bailiff should be paid more than 4 pence for an arrest unless it was an exceptionally serious case. Finally, the regulations make clear that no one could bring any case to the bishop's court involving monies above 40 shillings or £2. Anything above that, the king reserved the right to deal with it. After all, these such cases could be lucrative. Supposedly, all stew holders had to register new sex workers arriving at their premises with the bishop's officials. And the bailiffs of the bishops were to search every stew once a week for miscellaneous infractions. Interestingly enough, there was the heartbreaking rule. No sex workers were allowed to take a lover of their own, quote, against the use and custom of the manor, unquote. One historian simply suggested, quote, the reason must have been economic. Time spent on free fornication meant less revenue for the whoremaster, the bailiff, and the bishop, unquote. And while these rules applied to the stews of Southwark, they also applied to any sex worker operating independently within the liberty. They must obey the same rules set out here for the stew holders. And finally, given the rise of the Flemish stew holders and the fear of Flemish monopoly we saw back in the 1380s, we also see the bishop claim measures would be taken to curb foreign stew holders and sex workers operating in London, but the details of this are very unclear. The impression we have is of Southwark, and by extension the rest of London until the edict of the mayor in 1417, is a lively place filled with sex workers and a busy, edgy scene in the market of sex. And this is important. While London did formally kick the red light district of the city to now south of the river, and while those London edicts did try to formally end all such places in London and its suburbs, including Southwark, we have to face facts that these measures simply did not work. And indeed, London was to remain wonderfully physically queer for times to come. The mention here of these events at the end of the 14th and the start of the 15th century are really the first hints of what was to come. From now on, running very distinctly in London going forward, behind the respectable history, there was a much more licentious history going on. Some eras seem to revel in it more than others, but London from now on can be formally said to have a very naughty side. Now, it probably had it before, but going forward, the stews were to remain in Southwark here for centuries more. Sex work was to remain a vibrant and thriving business, and the issues London faced here and now would face again and again and again, rather relentlessly. The naughty history of London really begins now. And yet, it would be easy to explain all of this and present this episode as a salacious snapshot into a debauched city, but that would be untrue. Remember, these are three separate things we're dealing with here. The regulations of London stews, the edicts forbidding the operating of stews in the city around 1417, and the Reichenau case from two decades before that. And as a podcast writer, I can place all three of them before you and, like, I don't know, some 15th century stew owner, whisper, and now kiss to each of them and allow you to enjoy the rather salacious result that they come up with. But it's never that simple. We do not know the exact date of the regulations, nor can we say Reichenau represents a queer icon or if he's just one enterprising pragmatist. What I do know from reading historians of the LGBTQ plus communities that have been homosexual in the past, as it is in the present, was all about creating and forming identities. In the face of a prevailing Catholic European culture, all queer men and women had, in one way or another, to construct identities for themselves in order to assimilate, cope, and find a place for themselves. Eleanor Reichenau can be seen as a trans woman operating on the margins of society, existing as an embroiderer and ending up in the sex work due to grooming by female sex workers. Eleanor Reichenau can also be seen as a persona used by a gender-fluid young person, and they would change between Eleanor and John, refusing to define themselves as binary in a world that could not even begin to conceptualize such ideas. And John Reichenau could also be seen as a gay man coping in a world that does not have a way of even conceptualizing homosexuality as that, or queerness in any way, and skirting around a repressive society, disguising himself in women's clothing to provide a veneer, a cover, by which they could meet others who also felt the same way. We, alas, will never know. It may be and probably is that the sex trade in London was to remain remarkably straight, cis and misogynistic. Sex workers in this period were overwhelmingly young women, overwhelmingly poor, overwhelmingly exploited. And because we're in this particular era of history, overwhelmingly young. Way too young. There is nothing glamorous about this. And what we actually see here is London doing to the sex trade what it did to every single other aspect of life in the city in this century. They added rules to regulate it and control it. What they did not want is situations like they had encountered with Reichenau, where they're presented with something that is beyond their ability to comprehend it and to control it. And even if that control is illusionary, London needs that illusion to make itself feel better. London would continue, a myriad of million issues as it moved forward in history and time. But it is here and now that we begin to see Londoners begin to try to come to terms with the fluid, complex and scary world of sexuality. It's never simple, we know that. Sexuality is as wide as the ocean and merely a reflection of the human experience, which is also broad and endlessly filled with variation. And all this episode shows that here and now, back in the 15th century, it was just as broad and just as fluid as it is today. Now, maybe they didn't have the words to articulate it back then, and maybe they could not conceptualize the myriad of colors in the rainbow. But these stories show that below that medieval surface, a wonderfully queer history of London did exist. And this story will be all the richer for it moving forward. Thanks for listening. Hope you can follow that one. An ambitious episode. Hope I made it. That's 150. Oof. Look at us go. I'll be back again next week for another chapter in the story of London. Thank you for listening. And thanks to everybody for all their support over the last 150 chapters. 150 chapters. And we're only in 1460. Oh boy, I'm going to be here for a while. This is Saul saying thanks for all your support. Hope you enjoyed that episode. See you next week. Bye.